hadn't said no to him with such scorn. For two reasons, however, there is only one possible end to their relationship with Talia. First, they can never let her go because, unlike with Danica, none of this is consensual. Second, they will inevitably tire of her and be done with her. Jack is right about many things, and he is especially right about variety being the spice of life. Considering all the girls in the thrilling movies that Mercer's mother bought for him and all the girls in the many movies that he bought for himself after Mother's death, Mercer has had many hundreds of relationships, and he knows how important new faces and new bodies are to keeping the fun in sex. There will be a new girl after Talia, and another after that one, as many as Jack can steal, and the magic will be sustained. This magic is their great destiny, to live like kings with absolute power here in their small kingdom, and never to live as peasants. When the time comes to be rid of Talia, Mercer participates in her disposal without even a moment of passing nausea. Such absolute power is no less exhilarating than sex itself. This is a world of wolves, as Mother said, and it is better to be a wolf than a sheep. They do not beat this girl as they did Danica. There are many ways to be finished with a girl. One thing Mercer learns by experience is that variety in the termination of relationships is as important as variety in the relationships themselves if they're going to be as fulfilling as possible.
9. Standing behind Mercer Gossage, Gary asked if there had ever been transmission problems with the man's Honda. Their host appeared bewildered when he looked up from his cold coffee and met Jane Hawk's eyes. Because Gary had not mentioned the perf board or the keys, because the Honda was in a garage or a barn where they couldn't have seen it, the question initially must have seemed to suggest an almost supernatural knowledge of Gossage's guilt. She saw the confusion quickly give way to a subtle display of apprehension. The creases at the corners of his eyes pleated, and his mouth tightened, and he sat up, slightly straighter, in his chair. Maybe he took 5 seconds to respond, maybe only 4. But Gossage's silence was freighted, full of fevered calculation, before he lowered his gaze to his coffee once more and said, "Oh, you mean Mother's Honda? Transmission problems? No. She loved that car. It never gave her trouble. She thought it was the best she ever owned. I never drove it, but I'd know if she'd had problems with it. After she died, I took off the tires and put the car up on blocks. It was too old to be worth much if I sold it. And since my own Ford pickup hasn't been as reliable as I'd like, I figured it was a good idea to keep the Honda just in case." If he had stopped after saying that his mother loved the Honda, he might have sounded innocent and unaware of the loaded nature of Gary's question. But when a guilty man was supremely confident that the scam he'd been selling had a gullible buyer, when he was then rattled by a question, he tended to talk too much, to spin out a rapidly crafted response with a lot of details that he supposed made his answer sound credible. Gary looked at Jane, and she met his eyes, and he put his cup of fresh coffee on the counter. He said, "Maybe it was your mother's love of Hondas that influenced Kathy Haskell to buy a used one." Directly across the kitchen from Gary, a pantry door opened, and another Mercer Gossage appeared, armed with a pistol in a 2-hand grip, firing as he came. 10.
It is Jack's idea to send photographs to Talia's mother, one of her daughter naked and alive, another of her daughter dead. "Wouldn't you like to stick a shiv in Brandywine's for throwing us away like a couple snot rags?" he asks Mercer, referring to the prostitute who was their biological mother. We send the photos to Talia's mother, it'll be like sticking a shiv in her. The next best thing to cutting Brandy herself. Mercer isn't at once convinced. You said Brandy is still alive. You could cut her for real. As it turns out, when Jack first tracked down Brandy, it didn't go well. He lost his temper and might have cut her then, but she is a tough woman running her own group of whores these days, and she is surrounded by tough people. If Jack goes back there, he's likely to take a bullet for his trouble. Maybe she did us a favor, Mercer says. Maybe if she'd kept us and raised us in that environment, we'd have had shitty lives. Jack Crockett mocks him. Shitty lives? You mean compared to your fabulous, glamorous first 39 years on Gossage Farm with your Iceman father and your lying mother who kept you like a pet and gave you porn movies when you were just 11 and turned you into a jerk-off artist afraid to go after real girls? Mercer has no response. Jack is straight, harder than Mercer, tougher-minded than Mercer, with no capacity for sentimentality. Jack seems so often to get directly to the undeniable truth of things. Mercer has indeed been raised on lies and doesn't always recognize truths as quickly as Jack does. Jack is also one of those wolves in human clothing that Mother often warned Mercer about. The kind Mercer used to fear, though now Mercer wants to be a wolf himself. To live without limits, without laws, without fear of others. Jack is showing his twin the way, and Mercer does not want to alienate Jack by arguing with him. Fact is, Jack says, what could have been better than living in that world, our whore mother's world, with a pimp for our daddy? When we were old enough, Dewey Gordon could have told his girls that it was part of their job to be all over his twin boys. We wouldn't have had to pay for it, not even buy the bitches dinner, and we sure as hell wouldn't have had to steal any damn girls. Because Mercer and Jack can't stick a shiv in Brandy Wines without risking a bullet, and because Lenore is dead and beyond harm, they stick a metaphorical shiv in the mother of Talia by sending her the photos. Jack drives all the way to New Jersey to mail them, and to look for a hot girl who will add variety to their lives. Pennsylvania must remain their Switzerland, neutral territory from which they neither steal any girls nor mail photos to grieving mothers. Pennsylvania is called the Keystone State, and it is the keystone of their strategy to avoid drawing suspicion to Gossage Farm. New Jersey is called the Garden State, and Jack says that is because they grow a lot of hot girls there. After Talia, Jack snatches a super cute 16-year-old girl named Lori and sends a photo of her to her mother within a day or two of taking her. Weeks later, when they have finished with Lori, he sends a second shot of the naked corpse. When he does the same thing with the next girl, Sandra, this becomes known as the mother-haters pattern. Thereafter, when each family receives the first photo, their anguish is greatly sharpened during the months that they must wait for picture number two. Jack likes to imagine what torment the families go through. They think they're so special with their nice houses and their education and their good jobs and their polished-up kids going to soccer practice, taking music lessons. But there's nothing special about them that I can't piss on and make it stink for them forever. Jack likes the girls, the sex, the power. But the way he sees it, there's also an element of social justice in what he and Mercer are doing. A balancing of the scales, payment for the injustices the two of them have endured. Sometimes they drink fine whiskey long into the night, talking, sharing, and Jack can often be funny, doing voices and imagining what's happening in the house of the family currently waiting for the second photograph. Jack and Mercer laugh together in these occasions, and it feels good to laugh. Mother never laughed much. Maybe she never laughed at all. Mercer can't quite remember. But laughter is a good thing.
11. Mercer Gossage's double erupted out of the walk-in pantry in a fury, as though jacked up on drugs. A demonic figure with a fiery flush on his face, eyes protruding with hatred and rage, pale lips skinned back from his teeth in a snarl. If he'd been self-controlled, Jane might have been cut down with Gary. But this guy got off on his anger. For him, violence was akin to an orgasm, and he hosed Gary with no regard for the fact that the magazine in his pistol held only 10 rounds. Gary reached to his right hip, to his belt holster, but he didn't get a chance to draw his gun. He took a hard hit, as did the cabinets and refrigerator. Full metal jacket hollow points, a massive first wound. Maybe instant death, and if not, a quick bleed out. The moment the pantry door flew open, Jane started to get up, but the Mercer Gossage who was seated across from her didn't thrust to his feet. Instead, he reached forward and under the table with his right hand, even as his chair stuttered backward slightly on the wood floor, which told her that he had a firearm fixed under the tabletop, held in clamps or a holster. Two men, two weapons, close quarters. That was a scenario with maybe an 80% chance of her ending up dead. In spite of being taken by surprise, she could draw and fire and take out one of them, but not both, before she was cut down. She wasn't fully to her feet yet, and the Mercer from the pantry had fired maybe 3 rounds, and Gary had taken at least one bad hit when Jane put her hands under the table, tipped it up and over and onto the nearer Mercer, overturning his chair with him in it. Maybe the bastard got the concealed gun before the table crashed onto him, maybe not. Gary, sliding down the stainless steel refrigerator door, his face a death mask. The other Mercer still shooting, maybe 4 rounds left in his magazine. Jane, only now, clutching the grip of the pistol in her belt holster. The door to the hall was open and near. She went for it, low and quick. A round shattered a pane of glass in a display cabinet behind her, and another tore a chunk out of the doorframe as she ducked into the hallway, spraying her with splinters. Crossing the threshold, she pulled the swinging door shut behind her. Twins. Kathy Haskell's mother hadn't told her that Mercer had an identical twin, which must mean she didn't know. Somehow, it was Mercer's secret. The mother-hater wasn't one serial killer. He had a kill buddy. They wouldn't come directly after her because there was a chance, however slight, that she might wait for them in a doorway along that narrow hall, which was a shooting gallery. They would expect her to sprint for the car parked in front of the place, and they would come after her from outside, each along a different flank of the house. She didn't have either the time or the inclination to run to the car and get away. Kathy was in the house somewhere. The girl had only been snatched 6 days earlier. She was here, and alive. She couldn't be left to die. Jane opened the front door, but didn't step onto the porch. A warm wind rushed through the screen door, hissing into the foyer. Let them think she had gone outside. Let them waste time searching the night. She turned away from the door as the invading wind pushed it all the way back against the foyer wall, and she ascended 2 steps at a time to the second floor. 12.
For more than 4 years now, Jack brings home fresh girls, a new one every couple of months. He is brilliant at stealing them, nothing less than brilliant. And the hunt for Mother Hater is the longest-running front-page crime story ever, ever, ever. Mercer has found his great destiny, as his mother predicted, the one truth she ever spoke. The clocks are running backward, and the house is outside of time, just like Mama Dede Labrique claimed, which is why the foolish authorities can't find them. The house is outside of time, and they are immune from discovery. They are kings in a world of peasants. The girls are thrilling, more exciting by far than any of those in the porn films. Romance with Danica was nice at the time, but now Mercer understands that Romance is just a distraction from the main business, an invention of the weak who are afraid to admit what they really want. Breaking the girls and using them is thrilling. When they are no longer fresh enough to be exciting, the variety of ways they can be killed isn't merely thrilling, but also exactly what they deserve. Because they are all whores who, if they had children, would throw them away like snot rags. Mercer is now dressing like Jack. They both wear black jeans, black t-shirts in warm weather, black and blue plaid flannels in colder months. Their haircuts were similar when Jack first arrived. Now, Mercer and Jack are identically barbered. The more precisely Mercer looks like his twin, the better he feels. The safer he feels, the less alone. They've got their mojo working big time. It's a Friday morning, 10 o'clock, a week after they finished with the most recent girl, and Jack has not yet gone on the hunt again. Kathy Haskell, daughter of Cousin Anita, soon to be returning to college for a new academic year, pays an unannounced visit while Mercer is upstairs in the shower. Kathy has visited before, and Jack has watched her secretly from another room, so he opens the door and lets her in, pretending to be Mercer. He takes her into the kitchen, pours coffee, and sets out a plate of mini-muffins that Mercer has made from one of Mother's recipes. Then Jack excuses himself and hurries upstairs to tell Mercer they have company. Mercer goes downstairs and spends some time with Kathy, pretending to be the same Mercer he was before Jack moved in. When Kathy is gone, the brothers convene in the kitchen. Jack slides the fingertips of one hand back and forth across the seat of the chair in which Kathy has been sitting. "I've said it before, bro, and I'll say it again. I really need a piece of that. She has all the right stuff in the right places." "This is our Switzerland," Mercer reminds him. "Anyway, not her. Never her. Like you don't want her. I don't. Back when she was 14 and you were 38, you spent a lot of time with her. Why?" "Mother and I spent a lot of time with Kathy, both of us, to get her back on the rails, straighten her out." "You didn't once think about getting in her pants?" "No. Bullshit. She's hot now. She must have been delectable then. No matter how hot she was, I didn't need her," Mercer says. "I had my movies." Jack grins and claps his hands. "So you did want to get in her pants. You wanted it so bad. I bet you spent hours and hours with your freaking movies, and every girl in them looked like her to you." Jack can't be deceived. He sees right through people, sees the truth of them. Jack would have seen the truth of Mother in a minute, the truth Mercer had not been able to see while Mother was alive. Mercer says, "Kathy flaunted it then. She was a tease. That's one of the ways she was off the rails. Boys were too important to her, and that's the way she got them interested." "Just another whore," says Jack. "She's off limits, Jack. She's family." "Her mother, Anita Haskell, is your cousin, huh?" "You know she is. And Anita's mother was my Aunt Gladys, my father's sister, which you also know. You said Gladys never wanted much to do with you and your mother, and neither did your cousin Anita. That's why Kathy would talk to us, because Mother and me, we weren't Anita and Gladys. We were different from them. You said it was you, not your mother so much, that turned Kathy around. Because I became like a father figure to her. Anita is a single mother. Kathy never had a dad in her life." "At 14, she was a real tease, huh? Did she tease you? A man 24 years older than her? Come on to you, flirt, touch your arm, your hand, your knee, and let her fingers linger, Yeah, well, but it didn't work with me, so she started to respect me. Jack laughs. Didn't work? I'm sure you remember telling me a minute ago she got you mega horny, but you didn't need her because you had your movies. You spent hours with your movies, and all the girls in them looked like her to you. I didn't say it that way. You did, because it's true. You wanted her, all right, but you couldn't have her because you were your mama's gutless eunuch. Real girls scared you. 38 and scared of real girls. Good thing I helped you put an end to that before you died of boredom. And here's something else to think about, bro. Your Aunt Gladys and Cousin Anita aren't family. Neither is Kathy. They aren't anything to you. Your family is a dead pimp and a burnt-out old whore who's turned herself into a female pimp. And me. Me. I'm your real family.
13. Gary Burkett, dead. Father-to-be, wedded only 2 years earlier. Rosalind Burkett, carrying a child who would be born fatherless, born into its mother's grief. This sucked. It stank. But Jane could not allow herself anger yet, or grief. Anger and grief would interfere with clear thinking, get in the way of survival. Faint light filtered up the stairs from the foyer, but the second-floor hall was as shadowy as a catacomb, the rooms to both sides as dark as cadaver vaults. She could suppress anger and grief, but she couldn't entirely quash fear. Some fear was good. It sharpened the senses. Long case clocks stood on both sides of the hall, as if they were death's hooded lieutenants, their arcing pendulums like scythes ready for the reaping. She sheltered between two of them, her back to the wall, head forward just far enough to look past the clock on her left and watch the head of the stairs. She tried her iPhone. No service. This was farm country, and she was a long way from a cell tower. In the kitchen, there had been a wall phone. A landline down there suggested a landline up here, most likely in the master bedroom. Find it. Call local law enforcement for backup. Then locate Kathy Haskell. Defend her until sheriff's deputies arrived in force. She couldn't hear anything but wind rattling the screen door down in the foyer, buffeting the walls of the house, keening across the roof. Creaks and pops of stressed joinery settled on her from the raftered attic. She stepped out from between the clocks, holding the iPhone at her side, aiming it at the floor, using it as a flashlight, fingers occluding part of the screen to minimize the risk that the killers seeking her outside might glimpse a ghostly radiance moving across a window. She found the master bedroom, a phone on a nightstand, dial tone. She keyed in the 3 digits on the nightstand phone, switched off her smartphone, stood in the dark. She didn't bother giving her location. It was already on the 911 operator's screen. Keeping her voice low, she identified herself, reported Gary down, ID'd Mercer Gossage and his twin as the killers. Catherine Haskell is alive somewhere here. Get me backup, fast.
Backup's rolling. Stay on the line with me.
Fuck that. If I don't move, I'm dead. The operator started to say something, and then was gone. As if someone had cut the phone line coming into the house. As Jane hung up the handset, light bloomed in the upstairs hall beyond the bedroom door. 14.
And me. Me, says Jack. I'm your real family. Jack is not just making a pitch to snatch Kathy Haskell. He is making this a non-negotiable condition for the continuation of his and Mercer's magical life together. Jack badly wants Kathy, and Jack always takes what he wants. Taking what he wants and never taking no for an answer is how he defines himself, and if that is no longer who he is, then he's lost. He's nobody. Mercer knows this is reckless. But Jack is always reckless, and it works for him. He's almost 44, and he's skated through a lawless life without one arrest. In addition to Danica, he's brought 21 girls to the farm over 4 years, tormented 21 families, and during his hunts, he hasn't once come close to being caught. Jack is charmed. Mama Dede Labrique has inoculated him against arrest and prosecution. That's what Jack believes, and no reason has been presented to suggest that he is wrong. Yet Mercer is worried. Mercer goes outside and stands in the yard and slowly turns in a circle. Turns in a circle again. Under the deep and profoundly empty sky, surveying the hundreds of fallow acres. Loneliness, a sense of being the only human being left on Earth, and isolation from all meaning and purpose swell within him at the mere prospect of Jack's permanent departure. He imagines being alone in the house at night, with no girl in the cellar to use, with no company but that of the 21 dead girls buried in the former hog pen. Without bold, exciting Jack at his side, Mercer will become a middle-aged nothing, as dull as ever he'd been before Jack arrived. Jack is the only family Mercer has or ever will have, and family is everything.
15. Groaning wind at the windows. Enshrouding darkness throughout the bedroom. Sudden light in the hallway. Jane with her Glock 19M in a two-hand grip. The switch for the hallway lights might be in the first floor foyer, or it might be at the head of the stairs, in which case at least one of the killers was already on the second floor. If they had gone outside, they had returned sooner than Jane anticipated. They knew there was no cell phone service. Maybe they came back so quickly because they realized she might be seeking a landline. The hard roar of a shotgun reverberated off the walls as if they were drum membranes. Here, on the second floor, toward the front of the residence. Glass shattered, wood cracked, buckshot rattled off metal. At once, another round followed the first. What was he doing? He wasn't shooting in fright at shadows and phantoms. People who kidnapped 21 girls and got away with it for 4 years weren't the type given to panic. A third round shook the walls. A fourth. A fifth. Those three seemed to come from elsewhere than the first two, perhaps from the east rather than the west side of the hall. He was clearing rooms. This wasn't how Jane had been taught to clear rooms at Quantico. When, as an agent, you had to be concerned about the safety of innocents, about rules of engagement. But it might be how a homicidal sociopath cleared rooms when he had a lot of ammunition and didn't give a rat's ass about collateral damage. There was nowhere in the master bedroom for her to take a protected shooter's position and nail him when he came through the doorway. A volley of buckshot would precede him. Evidently, he was also shooting into closets, bathrooms, into any adjacent space in which he thought she might be hiding, which is why the blasts were coming in groups of 2 and 3. The shotgun probably had a 3 or 5 round magazine, plus one in the breech. He'd spend one round from the hallway, chop the room with buckshot, enter with 3 or 5 more rounds ready. As the 12-gauge roared, Jane slipped through the darkness to the rectangle of moonlit glass. After a 2-second silence, during which she twisted open the lock on the double-hung window, the weapon boomed again. If the window was painted shut, she was dead before backup could get here. The bottom sash slid up easily, wind in her face, its 10,000 voices whispering in her ears. Beyond lay the back porch roof. She eased through the opening, pulled the sash shut, stepped to one side, and pressed her back to the clapboard wall. Glock in both hands, muzzle toward the night sky. Intervening rooms had somewhat muffled the shotgun fire, so she wasn't temporarily deaf from the volume of sound, but she couldn't hear clearly either. Her pounding heart sounded strangely distant, like the ominous cloven hoofbeats of a predatory beast in a dream, forever circling her just beyond the limits of vision. To her right, a shotgun blast shattered the window, and in the aftermath of the muzzle flare, the killer switched on the bedroom lights. 16.
During Kathy Haskell's drop-in visit, she mentions that she is spending the night with a high school friend, Lisa Schuster, on the Schuster family dairy farm and leaving from there for college at 8 o'clock in the morning. Having lived largely in the isolation of mother's love, Mercer doesn't know the Schusters or the location of their operation, but in a few minutes on the internet, he finds them. At 7:30 a.m., Mercer is in his Ford pickup, parked along the two-lane county road 3 miles south of the Schuster place. At a few minutes before 8, he gets out of the truck and puts up the hood and pretends to be troubleshooting a breakdown, though, in fact, he is watching the southbound lane for the first sign of Kathy's 10-year-old Honda. She is a punctual girl, always has been, even when she was 14 and going off the rails, and she shows up at 8:06. As she approaches, Mercer slams the hood, contriving to appear annoyed and distracted, moving to the driver's door of the truck, not paying attention to the approaching car. She taps her horn and pulls off the road in front of the pickup. Mercer bends down to the driver's window, expressing surprise at this fortuitous encounter. Because Kathy knows that he is not familiar with the Schuster family, she believes he doesn't realize they live only 15 minutes from Gossage Farm, and she finds this crossing of paths innocent, serendipitous. Mercer gives her some flim-flam about a cracked distributor cap. She knows that he repairs his own vehicle, so it's credible when he says he has a spare cap at home. Because they are still in a zone without cell service, Mercer asks if she could drive him to his place, where he can grab the part he needs, and then return him to the broken-down pickup. Because Mercer spent so much time talking sense to her 6 years earlier, Kathy is happy to oblige. They are together at the roadside perhaps a minute. No traffic passes in that time. No one has seen them together. During the ride to Gossage Farm, Mercer is amazed as he listens to himself chat with Kathy, as if he has no foul play in mind. He is so smooth at this. He thinks, I have become Jack, and this greatly pleases him. She doesn't mind being delayed half an hour or more to aid him because she feels that she owes him. He feels that he owes her, too. Owes her for the way she teased him back in the day. Came on to him with her eyes and her straying hand and all the wiles of her body, when he was merely Mercer and too weak to take advantage of what she offered. She had at times laughingly mocked Mercer for his timidity, and he owes her for that as well. As they draw near the farm, a savage glee swells in Mercer, an almost rapturous feeling of absolute power. Breaking Kathy and using her will be a special pleasure. But Mercer suddenly understands that killing her will be even more thrilling than the sex, because she is the last remaining reminder of the feeble, timid fool that he had once been. When Kathy is dead and buried in the hog pen, Mercer will have erased his past, and he will be entirely, entirely as ruthless as Jack. The empty sky and the fallow land will not disturb him anymore, and he will never be alone because there will be Jack, and there will be an endless series of girls. With the clocks and the counterclocks stalling the flow of time in the timeless bubble that is Gossage Farm. Kathy parks beside the barn in which Mercer maintains his mechanics shop. When she disengages her safety harness and switches off the engine to wait for him, he distracts her by saying, "There's something I need to say to you. Something I've wanted to say for a long time." She regards him with interest and is frozen in shock for a moment when he says, "You're a totally hot bitch." Which is precisely when Jack pulls open the driver's door and grabs her by the hair and pulls her, screaming from behind the wheel. There is no one to hear her scream except Mercer and Jack, who are wildly excited by it. Jack gets an arm around Kathy's neck and drags her to the ground while Mercer runs around the Honda with the zip ties that he will use to bind her wrists and ankles. When Kathy is locked in a room in the cellar, Mercer pulls the Honda into the barn. Jack drives his Chevy van with Mercer aboard to where the Ford pickup was left alongside the county road. In separate vehicles, the brothers come home to their glorious destiny.
17. Jane, on the porch roof, back pressed to the clabbered wall, the wind rushing down out of the moon and seeming to shimmer the lunar glow through the turbulent night. The window exploding into the wind, sudden light in the bedroom. Another roar. Shotgun pellets ripping through something inside, maybe through the flimsy sliding doors to the closet. The weapon booming again, probably clearing the ensuite bath where the door had been standing half open, a ringing cascade of bathroom mirrors dissolving from the walls to the floor. In extreme circumstances, she took crazy risks because the odds said that crazy was, in that situation, rational. If the odds were backed up with a flash of intuition, she moved fast, using what she had learned at Quantico. But she didn't allow by-the-book rules to override her gut. Her pounding heart shook her arms. Bite on the fear. The sloped roof didn't permit her preferred shooting stance, but with the 9mm Glock and a two-hand grip, she stepped boldly into the outfall of light and saw Mercer Gossage, or his twin, starting to turn away from the bathroom toward the hallway door. He saw her, too, and swung toward the blown-out window. The orange post of the Ameriglow gun sight was radiant in the low moonlight, and she squeezed off four shots, 147-grain Speer Gold Dot G2 rounds, three hits. A shotgun fell from the killer's hands with his last shell still chambered. With a wheezy gasp of shock, as though his mortality surprised him, he staggered backward and fell and curled on his side in the fetal position, clutching the right side of his abdomen to staunch the blood spurting between his fingers. He screamed in agony as Jane climbed through the lower sash, careful not to snag herself on the remaining shards of glass. Although she didn't want to put the murderous bastard out of his misery, wanted him to suffer as his victims suffered, his screams masked whatever sounds his brother might be making. So she booted him onto his back and shot him point-blank through the heart. His left hand slipped off the wound, which ceased spurting when his heart stopped, and Jane saw that his right hand was pressed not to the torn flesh, but instead to the pistol in his belt holster. He had lacked the strength and clarity of mind to use it. For a few seconds, crossing the room, eyes fixed on the open door to the hallway, she heard nothing but the ringing in her ears, the wind keening at the broken-out window, and her tom-tom heart pounding the rhythm of mortal dread. Then the other twin shouted from downstairs, "Jack? What the fuck? What's happening, Jack? Jack? Jack!" So it was Mercer below. She eased through the doorway and looked toward the stairs. He wasn't coming up. He let out a long, despairing cry, chilling and childlike in its shrillness, revealing that he was moving out of the foyer and along the hallway toward the kitchen. Jane ejected the magazine from the Glock, in which only four rounds remained, dropped it in a pocket of her sport coat, snapped a fresh magazine into the pistol, and moved toward the stairs. Kill buddies were rare, though not unprecedented. Emotionally bonded sociopaths. The cruelty of the one inflamed the violent passions of the other in a feedback loop that excited them to ever more outrageous abuses of their victims. Jane, on the stairs, careful not to take a fall. The banister on her right, but of no use to her because her right arm was her gun arm. Glock, just under her line of vision, the steps seeming to rise and fall like waves over the Ameriglow gunsight. Mercer had stopped screaming. He might be coming back. Jane, breathing through her mouth, pressure on the trigger, eyes fixed on the landing. Then, on the span of stairs from the landing to the apparently deserted foyer. The feedback loop between bonded sociopaths might be only a fraction as intense as that between sociopaths who were identical twins. In either case, this isolated property would have become a bubble universe to them, the rest of the world a mere virtual reality game in which they hunted women. Clocks running forward, running backward, their universe outside of time, with only two stars, Mercer and Jack, each orbiting the other, each dependent on the other's light. Now, one of them a dead star, the other collapsing into a black hole. When Jane reached the foyer, Mercer's despairing cry rose again, not from the back of the house, but from below, the cellar. And then, a woman's scream. Mercer's fury, fear, and hate were of such gravity that what remained of his corrupted soul was being torn and crushed and sucked into an outer dark beyond mere darkness. Less than an hour ago, he had been an all-powerful ruler of his universe, but now his only power was to kill one more victim. Jane ran along the hallway, heedless of the rooms to either side, burst into the kitchen, and saw what must be the cellar door near the pantry. Locked. She shot out the lock, yanked open the door. Concrete block walls, wooden steps with rubber runners, light below. Neither Mercer nor Catherine Haskell screaming now. He, silent. She, sobbing and pleading for her life. Jane descended. 18. The scent of mildew. Low raftered ceiling. Oil-fired furnace. Water heater. Two overhead LED bulbs in cone shades. The sky blue wall against which the mother hater photographed the naked girls. A webbed and spidered place of focused light and sinuous shadows. Jane thought of sweet Nick and precious Travis, husband and son. Her reasons to be bold, but not reckless. Reasons to live. And she thought of Vanessa, her murdered mother. Her reason for being here at all. For choosing the law over music. Justice over safety. Ahead, a steel door stood ajar, separating the first room from a second. A different quality of light beyond that threshold, a bit brighter, but amber rose. Kathy's trembling voice, "Please don't! Please don't! Please! Please! Oh God! Please!" Jane took cover behind the doorframe, at the side with the hinges. Peering through the gap between door and jamb, she saw a nightstand, a lamp with a tasseled shade that was the source of part of the light, a portion of an unmade bed. But there was no sign of the killer or his captive. She called the troll's name. "Mercer Gossage?"
"Come watch me kill this slut," he shouted.
"It's over, Mercer."
"Over for you. Over for this whore I've got here."
"I called for backup."
"You lying pig. You didn't have time. I cut the phone line."
"Jack is dead."
"Better go look again, bitch. Jack wears two wristwatches."
"So fucking what?"
"Mama Dee Dee's New Orleans voodoo watch. He'll live forever.
The twins' bubble universe was constructed with elements of magical thinking, not uncommon among homicidal sociopaths. There should be a way to use that against him. How?
Come on! Come in! Come watch me blow the brains out of this dirty little tease!
He had been the cruel master of his isolate world, in his mind as powerful as a god. Now his potency evaporated, and he raged in denial of his reduced circumstances. The only proof he had that his reign had not drawn to an end was his power to kill one more woman. But he evidently needed Jane to witness his Olympian authority, maybe because he thought that proving his continued ability to play the executioner would magically undo what change she had wrought in his universe, would reinflate the bubble and restore his godlike might, resulting in her death as well.
Come in and watch me kill this snotty college slut. What are you afraid of, bitch? Afraid of being buried in the hog pen with the others? You will be. You will be. Jack and I will piss in your grave before we close it up. Come look. Come see. Come know.
Backup from the thinly staffed sheriff's department might take 12 to 15 minutes to get there, which meant she would be on her own for another nerve-rattling 7 minutes or more. But now, she abruptly dreaded hearing the approaching sirens, because that sound might bring home to Mercer Gossage the truth of his situation, deflate his faith in magic, whereupon he might forego a witness and kill Kathy Haskell for sheer spite. In a voice raw and demonic and hot with impatience, Gossage shouted, "Get in here, you stupid twat! Watch me do it! Watch me, bitch! Watch me!" Judging by what Jane could see of the chamber beyond the threshold, it was longer than the one in which she stood, maybe 30 feet from the door to the back wall. It would almost surely be about 40 feet wide, as was this front room. Gossage wasn't going to be near the door. He'd be holding the girl against him in a far corner, the gun to her head. As long as he used Kathy as his shield, Jane wouldn't have a clear shot at him. On the other hand, he wasn't trained at Quantico, wasn't top of the class in marksmanship, and at a distance of 30 feet, an inexperienced gunman would miss more often than hit his target. Kathy cried out in pain and terror, "He's biting! He's biting me!" Immobility leads to a collapse of nerve, to failure, to death. Get off the X. If you move, you live. You save lives. Pistol in a two-hand grip, Jane shouldered open the door and went into the rape room low and fast. 19. Jane, through the door, block in front of her, taking in the entire scene at once. Amber rose lamplight, a bed with disheveled sheets, an armchair, a toilet, a sink, two walls mirrored floor to ceiling. In the farther corner, the kidnapped girl wearing only panties, Gossage behind her, his left arm around her neck, gun in his right hand, its muzzle hard against her temple. A cruel bite mark in the muscle of her right shoulder. Blood oozing down her breast, blood on Gossage's mouth and chin, teeth glistening in a fierce grin. He intended the bite to draw Jane into the room, and here she was. In fact, two Janes, herself and her image in one mirror. She didn't like how frightened she looked, a sheen of sweat on her brow. Gossage was maybe 7 or 8 inches taller than Kathy, head exposed above the girl's right shoulder. But he rocked from side to side and forced her to sway with him. Jane couldn't risk a shot. She took another step into the room. The muzzle of Gossage's pistol slid from Kathy's temple to her jaw, and the killer warned Jane.
"Come an inch closer. I blow off this whore's jaw. Scatter her teeth and chunks of her tongue all over the room. Let her bleed out. Let her know excruciating pain. because you took an inch.
Jane said, tell me what I can do to stop this.
Nothing.
You want something from me, or you'd already have done it.
I want you to stand there, bitch. Stand right there until Jack comes up behind you. Then you can watch me kill her. And 2 seconds later, he'll blow your head off. And everything will be like it was.
Jack is dead.
Liar. Liar, liar, liar! The clocks are ticking. You brought some way bad mojo into the house, but the clocks are ticking. Some forward, some backward. And you're no Mama Dede. You're just a dumb twat with a badge.
4 years of holding absolute power over 21 girls. 4 years of indulging every demented fantasy of rape and torture. 4 years of committing one atrocity after another, with never a negative consequence, had convinced him that Gossage Farm was a world unto itself, where no transgression would be punished. However, sirens were imminent. When he heard the sirens, the last of his delusions would expire. His pent-up rage and hatred, purified and intensified through years of violence, was like a brick of C4 explosive waiting for an electric spark. When Mercer Gossage detonated, he'd take the girl out with him rather than die alone. Jane had to do something to change the situation, play to his need to hold fast to his fool's paradise. She said, "Kill me instead." His grin settled into a contemptuous sneer.
What shit is this?
Let her go, and I'll die for her.
I'm supposed to believe... What? You're some saint with great tits?
Somehow she had to craft this moment so that it flowed with the fluid strangeness of a dream. Mercer Gossage had been living a dream for years. A nightmare for his victims, but a fantasy of supernatural power for him. And lulling him into that waking dream state might make him overconfident and prone to miscalculation. She said, clocks are ticking forward and backward, right? There's no time here, right? Death doesn't happen here. You kill me and I still live, right? Lank with sweat, his hair fell into his face as he swayed back and forth with his hostage, and he shook his head.
It doesn't work that way.
So how's it work?
It only works that way for me and Jack. He has the voodoo watch, and I have mother's clocks, and you don't have either. You have nothing.
I think it works for me. In fact, I know it does.
Did it work for all the sluts buried in the hog pen? Go out there and ask those rotting whores if it worked for them. It only works for me and Jack.
Let her go, Jane repeated, and I'll die for her.
You must think I'm as brain dead as you are.
Jane slowly lowered the Glock. She tossed it onto the unmade bed. The gun landed on the pillows, too far for her to reach it easily. He regarded her with disbelief.
You're one crazy fucking bitch.
Something's happening to me. Something weird, but good. I feel all the clocks ticking, Mercer. I feel them in my bones. She took a step toward him. Don't you feel them ticking in your bones? In your blood? They're ticking, ticking. Ticking inoculates me against time and aging and death. Kathy Haskell wept, either pleading with Mercer or warning off Jane.
No, 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 no!
Don't you hear Mama Dede, Mercer? Her sweet black voice, soul of the bayou? I feel the clocks in my bones, and I hear Mama Dede whispering all the way from out there in New Orleans.
You don't know Mama Dede. You don't hear anything.
Jane took another step. I'm not like the girls in the hog pen. I'm meant to be here as much as you and Jack are, to live outside of time.
You said Jack is dead.
I thought he was. I really did. But now, I know he's not. I feel the ticking and I feel Jack rising. She took another step, aware that she now cast two reflections, one ahead of her, another in the mirrored wall to her left. Mercer's back was against the first mirror, so he cast a reflection only in the second. Three Janes, two Mercers. She dared not take another step yet.
There's three of me, do you see? Kill me here, and I'll still live there. Kill me there, and the third me still lives. Kill the third, and I'll come alive here again, under the spell of the clocks.
Without Jack at his side, Mercer's magical thinking was not easily sustained. But now that Jane professed a newfound faith in the power of the clocks, and threw away the Glock to prove it, Mercer seemed to feel a renewed hope. He was desperate to believe that his bubble universe could be reinflated, and his desperation combined with his confusion made him vulnerable. The muzzle of the pistol remained against Kathy's jaw.
"You're scamming me,"
he said, but it sounded more like a question than an accusation. "This cheap slut doesn't belong here, Mercer. I belong here." She opened the top button on her untucked blouse. "You and Jack and I belong here, but she's just another piece of ass." Jane opened the second button, the third, dared to take another step, and her fear swelled. His mind was a snake's nest of uncountable sexual depravities, writhing with violent desires. And intuition told Jane to play to that part of him no less than to his serpent's knot of squirming superstitions. His gaze fixed on the fullness of her breasts and the cups of her bra.
"You could be Danica. Nothing's been the same here since Danica. Are you Danica?"
Jane had no idea who Danica might be. Whether it was safe or dangerous to allude to being an incarnation of her. "What do you think, Mercer? Does Danica belong here?"
"Yeah. It was different with her."
"Then kill me and see if I belong here. If I belong here, I can't be killed. And I know I belong here. I'm taking no risk at all. Kill me, Mercer, and live here with me." His expression was that of a man born on the vapors of a perplexing but enchanting dream. As Jane closed to within 10 feet of him, he turned his pistol away from Kathy. Jane opened the last button on her blouse. "Kill me." The barrel of his weapon swung toward her. She put her hand on the grip of Jack's pistol, which she had tucked in the waistband of her jeans, under her blouse. Mercer moved in the laconic flow of a dream of power. Jane moved with the fast-forward efficiency learned in Quantico. She firing point-blank in his face, he reflexively squeezing off a round that singed her hair as it passed a millimeter from her skull. She cried out, "Shit, shit, shit!" as he collapsed backward into the corrupted sludge that had once occupied his head and that now slid down the mirror. Sirens wailed. Kathy fled the corpse, rushed into her rescuer's arms. Holding the terrified girl, Jane couldn't tell which of them was shaking the most, although she, unlike Kathy, wasn't trembling with residual terror, but with relief and gratitude. And with a humbling awareness that she hadn't failed this girl as, so many years ago, she had failed to ensure justice for her mother. However, as she helped Kathy dress, Jane's joy was tempered hard by the loss of Gary. Fine man, good partner, friend. By the thought of Rosalind left alone, and by an awareness that what this young girl had suffered during the past 6 days would weigh upon her for the rest of her life. Upstairs, on their way to meet the county sheriff's deputy,